Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast, brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series that is written by Robert Jordan.
Currently, there are 11 main books in the series and one prequel novel.
Final book, currently titled A Memory of Light.
And the Fourth Age podcast is dedicated to that series.
To contact us, please visit our website at www.dragonmount.com/podcast.
Hello, everyone. As promised last week, we will be discussing the Aelfin and the Aelfin. One thing that's always stuck in my mind was the question, how can I win the last battle and survive? This was one of the questions Rand answered, and we finally get the response given by the Aelfin in Knife of Dreams. They answer, "The north and the east must be as one. The west and the south must be as one. The two must be as one. To live, you must die." An interesting line of thought. These strange otherworldly creatures who seem to be able, one set of them, to see the pattern, see what may lie ahead if people take certain courses of actions, and one set who seemingly are able to produce or to grant some sort of wish or request via a contract with people from the normal world. How can we describe these rather ambiguous creatures?
Well, I see them kind of as aliens that are from like a very scary movie, you know? Like, I think they're the kind of people that would abduct you if they had the chance. But how would we explain them? I would say that they're people, as Brigitte says, that are so alien they might as well be evil, so different in their ways, and they feed off of sensation or emotions or feelings or some kind of aspect of that. I would explain them as kind of leechy, vampiric, powerful, and almost civilized. It's a very odd combination, almost like you found a zombie with a brain. I don't know if that's a bit over the limit there. I don't know, what's your impression, Virginia? What do you think of them?
They definitely live in another dimension, and Moraine says that their world is folded in some sort of way that might make it possible for them to read the pattern. I think she was talking about the Aelfin at that point. Birgitta says basically what you said, that the Finn are not evil the way the Shadow is evil, yet they are so different from humankind that they might as well be. They are not to be trusted. And we know that the answers that are received from the snakes are always true, even though they're not easily understood, and that the requests are always granted, though not always as intended by the petitioner. So in some ways they kind of remind me a little bit of Aes Sedai. You know, the truth you hear is not always the truth that they actually spoke. Kind of a strange group of people. I can't even imagine how they could have ever even been discovered and how the doorways might have even been created. The Tarangriel doorways and then the Tower of Genje as the other way to get into their realm.
I wouldn't even dabble on the contemplation of how they make contact. That's Age of Legends stuff, which obviously is too much for us to contemplate. They make constant reference about these amazing things, like when Rand and them do traveling and they do something else, the Forsaken are kind of like, you know, like in our day, that was nothing. That's half of what we can do. I mean, once you get a Sa'angriel in your hands, I mean, we've seen the difference. Once Rand gets something in his hands like that, he does these things that you couldn't even believe. I mean, thank God none of the Forsaken have held a Sa'angriel that I recall at this time. Suffice to say that at some point in time, somebody contacted somebody, and the Aelfin and the Aelfin were a society that, under the impression I got, made a contract with people from various worlds, if not just this world, where certain conditions had to be met before people would meet and agree upon certain contracts and things like that.
Yes, and the game of snakes and foxes is evidently based on those old dealings with the Aelfin and the Aelfin. And the that makes me think of the quote that you used to open the game, which Oliver sort of introduces us to. And the quote is, "Courage to strengthen, fire to blind, music to dazzle, and iron to bind." And that's a very Celtic mythology sort of thing, too. It reminds me of the, I can never say it properly, the Tuatha Dé Danann. So I'm not quite sure.
That idea of the music being so beautiful that, you know, these otherworldly creatures would just kind of stop and pay attention to absolutely nothing else, and that cold iron would inflict the most serious of wounds upon them.
Yeah.
It's kind of always, I have to admit, when we first were introduced to that little poem, I always thought that, you know, the people going in to be, you know, to save Moraine would end up being Tom because of the music, and Matt with the fireworks, you know, being, you know, a new form of fire. And then, of course, Perrin, because he was a blacksmith. And it was just one of those things that, and, you know, now we've kind of got Noel instead of Perrin, and it's like, well, kind of a shame on my part, but at the same time, it would have been a little contrite to have, you know, most of our main heroes charging off again, you know, on the side tangent with, you know, Tarmon Gaiden looming directly in the background, so.
We don't have enough information. They're mentioned so vaguely. I mean, this last book is going to have so much revelation, I hope, to give us an understanding of why did he even bring them up. It's like, so we've got a story going on here, and so-and-so is going along the way. Oh, he needs some answers. Well, let's make another dimension where he can go ask some questions, okay? And then we continue on. Matt didn't like his answers, so here's another doorway. Let's go through here, grant him some wishes. Oh, okay, changes everything, catapults Matt along. Okay, now Matt's suddenly a serious character with more than just luck on his side. And then they drop them in here and there, and it's like, what was the point, you know? And I'm hoping in this next book it's going to really kind of unleash the core of what interdimensional or inter-reality travel will really mean to this series of books.
I don't know, but the more I read through these books, I must be on my 8th or 9th or 10th circuit through the whole books, the more I read through the books, the more I realize that Robert Jordan didn't put anything in there casually. Everything is related to everything else, and it all means something, and that's why he can sit, when he was alive, he would sit there and say, read and find out. It's all linked together in this massive, it's like the weave of the pattern. It's amazing how he could keep it all straight, but I'm sure that they're going to have an extremely important role to play somehow. If nothing else, just because if Moraine comes back, suppose she's able to bring back some knowledge or some ability from the world of the Ilfin and the Aelfin, because she said, you know, Sindane said she was held by both of them, not just one or the other. And what if Moraine brings back something that is crucial to Rand for the last battle? And actually, I think Min had a viewing about that too. She said that Moraine was the only viewing of hers that ever failed, and how could she tell Rand that he would almost certainly fail unless a woman who was dead and gone was there at the last battle? I don't remember where that quote was, but I remember the reading about it. Yeah. So I think they're going to be really important in more ways than just giving Matt his Ashandarai spear and his foxhead Tarangriel. Maybe Egwene and Elaine will get a hold of that fox head and learn how to make something that will be a powerful protection for Rand or something for the last battle.
On a side note, I actually think it was Lanfear, who is now Sindane, who might actually turn from the dark side and help Rand still. Because, I mean, no matter what, at the core of it, her love is a constant throughout the series, even though her anger, you know, makes her violent and evil, and she has some bad stuff she's done, like horribly evil, but she loves Luz Theron, or the concept of him, so much that it drives most of her motives and goals. And now that she's been reincarnated and tied to a Korsuva, she knows she's no longer going to be at the top. She knows she's pretty much a slave, so the only thing left to her is her love for Luz Theron. I mean, even when she's up against at Shedar Logoth, when they're cleansing the taint on the source, she's there and she's still jealous and angry at Luz Theron for allowing someone else to share the female Sa'an Greal with him, and she's just all bent on, you know, her emotions, her scorned love. And I mean, she's not going to be Nablus. She knows that now, is my brief theory of the day. Isn't she significantly weaker than Lanfear was? Like, she was cured.
When she confronts Alivia, the Shanshan woman, while Rand and Nynaeve are cleansing Sidene, she thinks to herself that Alivia is stronger than Sindane was. Sindane was when she was Lanfear, before she was held by the Ilfin and the Aelfin. and she didn't think that was even possible. No woman could have been stronger than she was before. And then she said she must have an Angriel, but we know that Olivia is plenty strong without it. But I think the only way, obviously, that Lanfear got out of the realm of the Elven and the Elfin was by... she died. And then that's how her soul is transmigrated into Sindane. Yeah. So, but we can assume then that Moraine may still be alive.
No, Ossengar and Arengar, who are Angior and Belathamol, I believe is the enunciation of his name, neither of them seem to be any weaker than... well, there's no indication that they're weaker than when they previously died. The only thing that would make me think of that is if Lanfear was severed and then healed by a female, or maybe the Lord has limited her power, the Dark Lord, I should say.
Yeah.
I don't know why she's weaker, but she is. It could be the elfin did something to her, who really knows. But the way they described it is if she was held by the elfin, that means that once they got through the gate, she wasn't killed by Moraine. She was held, so captured. Something happened. I don't know. Hopefully more of that will be revealed.
But maybe they killed her. I mean, Moraine did say that even questions touching on the shadow could have dire effects, and what could be more touching on the shadow than having a forsaken pop in there? Maybe they held her and then killed her. Or reduced her in power.
And that actually ties into a set of long-stringed theories that I have put together and dismissed and brought back up, and I think this is probably an appropriate place to kind of discuss this.
Yeah, go for it.
We know that the dealings with the Finns is an ancient one. It's existed for a very amazingly long time. Going on a slight tangent that will get to the point, I promise. Older than men and women channeling was the connection of the Wolf Brothers. Now, the wolves tell Perrin this a long time ago. It is my supposition that if they cannot actually channel themselves, that the Finns are in some way, shape, or form capable of manipulating the power, even if they're not using it in the same way that humans did. I'm thinking where this goes is that the Finns might actually have been the ones to teach either men and women to either channel or to manipulate the power in order to be able to create Tarangriel. Matt's Foxhead seems very, very specific to him. The Ashandari, which is power made, is inscribed with words that were meant for him. These are very specific things. I'm not wondering if they might not have been able to manipulate the power to bind Lanfear and make sure her power is not as great as it once was. They also are holding Moraine. We know that if you follow the contract properly, you should be able to ask them for things. We don't know if Moraine has actually asked the Eelfin for anything, and if they did, what the price was. Maybe her being held and tortured, as it's assumed she has been, is part of her paying them for whatever it was that she asked for, which kind of ties into that idea that she might come back with the ability to help Rand, even though everyone assumes she's been dead.
I actually assume that she's probably just sitting there hoping for rescue and waiting for it, and they're feeding off that emotion. I think any emotion at all is kind of what they feed off of. I don't think the torture itself is necessarily what's required. Mm-hmm. Maybe she's just like, hey, I just want to sit here and wait for my rescuer.
Yeah, this is true.
Yeah, they feed on sensations and experiences. Yeah.
My other thought, and this kind of ties in again to something that was said earlier in the podcast, was that questions touching on the shadow can have dire or deadly consequences. Why? My thought here, and this may be stretching it into the realm of an incredibly crazy theory, is that we know Trollocs were created using human and animal stock. And if the Finns hate the shadow so severely, it's not outside of the realm of the possibility that at some point one of them may have been somehow captured by the shadow and used in that particular genetic manipulation. My reasoning behind this is that their world is very alien, it's twisted, and you know, multiple people can be in the same place at the same time and not see or notice each other at all. The fades are a back throwing of mating between two Trollocs. They come out mostly human, yet they have no eyes, but can see as well as eagles. Their cloak and clothing hangs still, as if it's not completely connected to the pattern, as if it's somewhere outside of the pattern, which was the theory on how they could possibly jump between shadows. It might be that the reason questions touching the shadow have dire consequences, because there is a somewhat private vendetta between the Finns and the shadow, because they were the animal backstock that was used to breed the Trollocs in the first place.
That's really an interesting theory. I like that. And, you know, actually, not to bring in other fantasy series, but that reminds me of how in Tolkien's world, the orcs were made from elves that were corrupted and degraded, and the various other evil races were made from men, you know, that were just twisted. It's sort of the same sort of thing. And we know that Robert Jordan draws on all kinds of mythologies and different literature in order to tie all these connections together.
It especially caught my mind because the Murdrel are always described as moving, you know, sounding, and, you know, even sort of looking vaguely snakish, particularly with their overlapping scale plates. They were just reminded of these dead black snakes that, you know, eventually, you know, were just had these creepy, uber-phenomenal powers, like the ability to cause fear, just abject fear in whoever they looked at. And if I remember properly, wasn't when they're describing Matt going into the Tirangriel, the first one in Tyr, wasn't he very disconcerted just by looking at them?
Well, they're alien.
Yeah, and I'm not wondering if there's not some other little connection. Like I said, I might be way out there on this one, but, you know, it seemed like there were a lot of connections there that all seemed to play together, and I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. But they clearly do, at least the Ilfin do away with people occasionally, because we have some of them wearing those harnesses of human skin that were all studded with the silver. So we know that people do go in there and die, because they're using their hides for harnesses. So we don't know what it is that causes some people to be able to escape with their answers and wishes and other people not. But they, you know, they always say in the game that the only way to win the game of snakes and foxes is to cheat. And so we have to figure that the people that probably get out of there know how to cheat, basically, or manipulate the Ilfin and the Elfin so that they can get out, which Matt just did by sheer luck both times. I mean, the second time he asked for a way out as one of his wishes. Otherwise, he'd probably still be there. But the price that it got out of him, we don't know what that is. It may be that they have the connection with his memories, which is what he's worried about, that they can actually read his thoughts.
Yeah, and actually might even know that they're already coming to try to rescue Moraine.
Right, he's very worried about that. He's afraid that they're peeking into his head at all times, because he thought about how he acquired the... How did the Ilfin acquire the memories of other men? You know, and they were all adult men, and usually right up until the time of death. And he speculated that the way that they were able to steal those memories was those men had gone into the Tirangriel, and they had kept the memories, and they were able to put those into his head. But they're obviously very powerful people, because they can do all these different things. You know, they can possibly create these Tirangriel, or at least have access to them, and they can stuff his head full of memories and grant these wishes. I mean, you can wish for anything in there, apparently, and get it. So they must be extremely clever about doing that. We didn't mention anything about the Tower of Genje. And Alvar told Matt that Birgitta had told him how to get in with a bronze knife, making the sign of the snakes and the foxes, the triangle and the wavy line sign with the bronze knife would open a door in the Tower of Genji, which apparently goes to both realms, which are separate but connected, apparently. Okay, I guess the next thing to talk about with the Ilfin and the Elfin is the prospected rescue that Tom and Matt and Noel are planning to rescue Moraine from the Ilfin and the Elfin after she disappeared through the Tarangriel doorway when she and Lanfear had their battle at the docks of Carrion. Now, what do you think is going to happen with that, Andrew?
Well, I honestly have to say I like Noel as a character. I don't think he's going to make it. I think they're going to go in to rescue. I think that Noel is probably Jane Farstrider, and that in his last great adventure he will sacrifice himself in order to bring it off that they rescue Moraine, which kind of also ties into another little pet theory, and it's just my night for theories, I guess, that while Matt, Noel, and Tom are going to be the ones who go into the tower together to rescue her, that Alver is going to sneak in after they have gone in, and that Alver being important, because RJ said he still had an important role to play, is going to be the one who's going to be responsible for all of them getting back out. So it's one of those kind of, that's my little theory of what's going to happen. Maybe, you know, it's just me kind of hoping that Oliver's going to prove more than a, you know, 12-year-old source of information that, you know, leads to the big rescue, because...
Wow, that's pretty interesting. But how do you think that's going to affect the... evidently, I think that was the vision, or the what Moraine learned when she went through the Tarangriel in Rhydian, the Wise One's Tarangriel, not the Doorway Tarangriel. And she wrote in the letter to Tom that it had to be these three. If there were more or fewer, they would probably fail and everybody might die. And if Oliver goes in after them, is that going to affect that somehow, or will that just not count because he didn't go in with them?
See, I'm thinking there's a way around it, and once again, in order to win with the snakes and foxes, you have to cheat, which is a big part that Oliver hasn't really learned yet.
That's true.
They make a point of Matt thinking that Oliver hadn't yet learned that that's the only way you can win at the game, is to cheat. What I'm thinking is that Oliver's not going in to rescue Moraine. I don't remember the exact wording on her letter, but I think it's if any more than three of you come to rescue me. You know, I think it might be a difference in intention that allows Oliver to find the little loophole that's going to let them, you know, cheat the rules and actually make it out. Kind of that same way four go in and four leave, you know, like the Varen going back to, the Great Hunt. Yeah, five go forth, yeah. And four return.
Five red forth and
it's
four return.
It's kind of those weird, interesting little creepy bits of woo, yeah. You know, what's going to happen. Maybe I'm just hoping for a more grandiose thing than might be possible.
I'm sure that Tom and Noel and Matt must be planning to cheat big time when they go in there, so one has to presume that they're going to have... the things that the foxes and the snakes agree that they're not supposed to bring in, the iron to bind and the fire and the musical instruments. I mean, I could see them sneaking in Aludra's fire sticks to make fire. They wouldn't, the elephant wouldn't know about that. But how are they going to sneak in musical instruments or even fireworks? Yeah, I hadn't thought about fireworks. I was thinking more of the matches that she developed.
Yeah.
Fireworks would be pretty awesome, though. Rand said they were definitely afraid of the fire sword that he channeled when he left. He said the sword kept him back. They wouldn't even look at it. They shied away and hid their eyes. And then, of course, I'm not really sure about how Rand was able to channel, and yet it had such dire consequences when Moraine and Lanfear were channeling when they entered the doorway. Maybe possibly because one or both of them had an Ungrail at the same time. I always keep thinking about how they said that two Tarangriel used in conjunction can generate resonances, as happened when Egwene was tested for accepted. So it makes me wonder, there in Rhydian, Matt was in his Tarangriel and Rand was in his, mm-hmm. you know, Shining Columns Tarangriel for the Aiel at the same time, and they're sort of dealing with the same sort of, you know, memories and other world and spirit and things of that nature, and yet there didn't seem to be any resonance between those.
Actually, it might have been a proximity thing, because remember, the Tarangriel Teleron Rihad stone ring was, like, feet away from Egwene's testing thing, and presumably it was a fair distance, the glass columns that Rand walked through from the twisted doorway and Avendessera.
It sounded like he came right out of the columns and saw Matt hanging. So they must have been close, and it says that that whole square was stuffed full of Tarangriel, remember? The other one that kind of, as I think I've said before, I don't think Robert Jordan put in anything casually. I think everything had a meaning. And there are a couple of times there were mentioned that there was a Tarangriel, and yeah. I think there was one in that square that was five dice fused together at the corners. And I'm wondering if maybe some resonance with some of those other Tarangriel, either in the Stone of Tyr
yes.
or in the Square in Meridian, might have helped to cause Matt's luck, you know, when he was in one of the doorways. But I always really thought that his luck came from the dagger in Shadow Logoth, mm-hmm. but I could be wrong about that.
I don't know. It's
getting off topic, too.
Getting back to the rescue, though, I so see Noel being the one to sneak in the iron. I mean, you know, the crafty old man with his, you know, his big daggers and whatnot, I can just see it being, you know, a Jane thing to do to suddenly, you know, oh, look, I have these iron knives that you didn't know about. And, you know, Tom, okay, yes, he might not have a musical instrument. Maybe he will, maybe he won't. The man's a great singer. And, you know, the human voice is one of the most mesmerizing...
That's true.
One of the most mesmerizing instruments
yeah.
that's ever been made.
I hadn't thought about him singing.
My own personal opinion. Matt's got the fireworks, but there, it keeps that poem in my mind always says... It always seems to ring out that there are four elements in the poem. Yet
well, they're all going to need the courage.
Are going in to rescue Moraine. And that's kind of what leads me back to that Oliver little... Maybe Oliver is the one that sneaks in the iron, and Jane, you know, slash mm-hmm. Noel is really the courageous one because he offers himself up. Once again, I'm validating my own theories here on, you know, circumstantial evidence, but...
Yeah, well, I found the quote from the letter that Moraine wrote. She said, "All will believe that I am dead. I am not dead, and it may be that I will, that I shall live to my appointed years. It also may be that you and Matt Cawthon and another, a man I do not know, will try to rescue me. May, I say, because it may be that you will or cannot, or because Matt may refuse. He does not hold me in the affection you seem to, and he has his reasons, which he no doubt thinks are good. If you try, it must be only you and Matt and one other. More will mean death for all. Fewer will mean death for all. Even if you come only with Matt and one other, death may also come. I have seen you try and die, one or two or all three. I have seen myself die in the attempt. I have seen all of us live and die as captives. Should you decide to make the attempt anyway, young Matt knows the way to find me, yet you must not show him this letter until he asks about it."
And see, once again, yeah, there's that weird little... bit in there, and it's always that you may try to rescue me, and I'm just not wondering if there's something about that, you know. Well, Oliver might not be trying to rescue Moraine, he might be going in to save Matt.
That's definitely a possibility. He certainly would have that as a that would be a powerful motivation for Oliver. Certainly, he doesn't know, I don't think he knows Moraine at all. She was gone before he came on the scene, so now I guess the question also would be, is Moraine being held as Sindane, or Lanfear was, by both the Aelfin and the Aelfin, or is she being held by only the foxes? The Aelfin, with a Meridian doorway. Well, I don't know. If Sindane was held by them both, you'd think they would end up in the same predicament. I just wonder why Moraine didn't negotiate a way out, you know, the way Matt did inadvertently by asking for release, because Moraine is certainly smart enough, being an Aes Sedai, and the way they learn how to twist words and manipulate people, you'd be pretty sure that she would know the ways to get what she needed out of either the Ilfin or the Ilfin. Is she performing her own sort of sacrifice by staying there for all this time and presumably having her sensations and memories rummaged through in exchange for some future benefit? Why does she need to be rescued? Why doesn't she just negotiate a way out?
I mean, she may have foreseen that her sacrifice would be necessary, either, you know, if it was nothing more than just weakening Lanfear, you know, to the point that she wouldn't be a threat or as great a threat to Rand anymore, or whether her prolonged stay is going to then benefit her when she is rescued.
Or perhaps one of her requests may be that she will have some, learn something or acquire some skill that will help Rand to win the last battle, because we do remember that viewing of Min's, she's always thinking that Moraine was the only viewing that she had that didn't work out, and how could she tell Rand that he would almost certainly fail without a woman who was already dead. So if she comes back, maybe she'll bring something to Rand or to the last battle that will turn the tide, and she feels that that's worth staying, you know, however amount of time she stayed there with the Ilfin and the Ilfin. I could see Moraine making that sort of sacrifice. It's a really Blue Aja thing to do.
Yeah, definitely one for the cause, Moraine always was. God, I already sound like she's already gone. I mean, wow.
Well, hopefully she'll come back, and, you know, I don't know what's going to happen when she comes back, but I always have a fond desire to see her and Tom get together, you know, either as a couple or as Aes Sedai and Warder. I think that would be pretty cool. I know that was talked about in a previous podcast. I think it'd be kind of a neat idea.
Yeah, well, I've always been a proponent of that in some way, shape, or form.
They certainly fit together well. Yeah, they certainly fit together well. I remember Tom musing that she had every grace a man could want, if only she weren't Aes Sedai. Except for that little detail.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, the only way we're going to truly know is when we read and find out. And to that effect, for any of you who in the audience who might not have heard yet, Harriet has chosen a proxy to finish the final book, the 12th book, A Memory of Light, in the series. I did not mention this early up front, and I apologize for that, because that probably should have come first in our news for the podcast. But we have had some word from Harriet via the blog at dragonmount.com, and I would like to take this moment to read at least a little bit of it and tell you what she says. She says, "Dear everyone, Brandon Sanderson came to see me for a couple of days this week, and he is terrific as he sounds in the interview. I am really glad that things have worked out so that he can and will complete A Memory of Light. He will do a job that Jim would approve of, I believe, and I'll be working with him throughout the writing, and so will Alan..." Oh, this is a name that I am going to horribly butcher, and I apologize in advance. Romanczuk and Maria Simmons, who have worked with Jim through a number of books and who are both now completely available for Brandon's support. It is a great relief to have Brandon on board. This, choosing the writer to finish the series and getting the work launched, was the single thing I most wanted to do for my dear Jim. All the rest of the avalanche of stuff had to take a back seat, and there has been a lot that needs to be dealt with. So now I can deal with it, figuring out one colossal bad investment, dealing with the apparent collapse of a British literary agency, and now apparently reconstituting itself, figuring out how to meet the payroll, all this mundane stuff. All will be okay, I hasten to tell you. It's just that it all needs to be dealt with, and that means time. There is an E.E. Cummings poem, I Carry Your Heart, that you can Google. The poem is included on the Dragon Mount website in Robert Jordan's blog. I did, and burst into tears. It tore my heart open and soothed it too, because I do carry Jim's heart in my heart, and I always will, until we meet again, which I hope and pray we will. When I said onward, I did not mean away from Jim. Not at all. I meant that we must always keep going, making, giving, loving, living as best as we can through blizzard and desert. It is what we are called on to do. A friend wrote to me at Jim's death, "The transition from love in the flesh to love remembered is endless and inconsolable." And oddly, this was very comforting because I believe it is true. It isn't the most important thing. The most important thing is to keep going, onward, with his love, in his love. He loved you guys too, you know, even if you never met him. How else could he have written these wonderful books? So hold him in your hearts and live. It's what he wanted us all to do. Greetings of the season to you all, and love, Harriet.
Wow, that's really great. You know, I've done a little bit of research on Brandon Sanderson. I must confess I didn't know anything about him, but there were some great links on the Dragon Mount site to his website, and Brandon Sanderson has a lot of really interesting things on his website, including a lot of sample chapters from his books, Mistborn and Elantris, and he actually has an entire book that he's working on called Warbreaker, and the entire text of it is available for you to read to follow along as he polishes the novel as a work in progress, although I think he set aside a lot of these things that he's been working on so that he can dive right into A Memory of Light. He also has a little indicator of what projects he's working on and what percentage of the project is complete. It's kind of fun to look at. And he sounds like a really great guy. I hope to be able to meet him someday. I was fortunate enough to meet Robert Jordan before he passed away, and that's a high spot of my life. And I love the interviews that Brandon has given. He sounds like a really, really cool person.
Yeah, definitely. Bearing that in mind, Brandon Sanderson, the person chosen by Harriet to finish A Memory of Light, is going to be the first of the topics that we will be discussing on our next podcast. If you have questions, comments, feedback, anything that you possibly want to write us in, if you want to write in digs on my horrible crazy theories from this episode, or you want to post your own amazingly crazy theories, you can get a hold of us by either emailing us at podcast@dragonmount.com, or you can give us a call on our toll-free line, which we were again using to take all sorts of viewer feedback. The phone number for that is 1-888-333-7690.
Yeah, we love to hear from you. We always enjoy to have either compliments or criticism. Make it constructive criticism, though. We don't want you to just be mean to us, because we're having fun doing this, and we hope you are, too. And we do read everything. We read all the emails, and I believe next episode we'll also be reading some of the emails that have been sent to us and commenting on them. So keep those cards and letters coming.
And speaking of that, there have been a lot of questions coming in about the apparent missing episodes. And our topic schedule that we had announced prior to episode 32. Episode 32 itself was recorded over a month before Robert Jordan's passing. We were in the final editing phase when he passed away, and immediately after recording the next episode, which was the special memorial tribute, which is on dragonmount.com on the podcast main page, we discussed quite thoroughly whether or not it would be in good taste to release an episode that was recorded so far in advance of the sad event, especially because up to that point all of our episodes had been very, very focused on what his current health state was, and always we were always mentioning not only that, but our continued assurances that, you know, he would be beating this thing and that he'd be, you know, back on track in absolutely no time. And we also kind of discussed recording a new version of episode 32 to insert in place of the original. We have not yet confirmed whether or not we are going to do that. It is possible that we will, and if so, we may entitle it episode 32, and we might not. We may just take that particular topic, which I believe was the Aiel, and transfer it to a later episode. All of our original topics that we did have online, we are still planning on talking about. We just decided to push them back a little bit until we get the current version of the podcast running a little more smoothly. As for episode 33, as I kind of mentioned a little bit, we didn't want to call the special memorial podcast episode 33 because that seemed really impersonal and it didn't reflect how we really felt. But episode 33 was the special memorial podcast. So there is, I will admit, one missing episode. We will endeavor in some way, shape, or form to get at least the concepts we talked about in that podcast to you at some point in the future.
Okay, that sounds great. I'm looking forward to that myself. We just also wanted to mention that all of the episodes are available on the DragonMount.com website under the Fourth Age podcast, even back to the very first one. And you can also subscribe to the episodes through iTunes. The Fourth Age has its own podcast section there, but only the most recent episodes are listed. And then we also have the MySpace page. So anyway, that's it for this episode, and we look forward to hearing from you and hope to hear some feedback from everybody. And in the meantime, until next time, may the light shine on you.
And from everyone here at the Fourth Age podcast, myself, Andrew Gellos, we'd just like to say, Saravya Ninto Manshima Tai Shite.
The Fourth Age podcast is brought to you by DragonMount.com. For advertising, please email advertising@DragonMount.com. The Fourth Age music is brought to us by Josh Needleman. You can visit his site at www.scriberocks.com. Thank you.